I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Well, it's official. After weeks of will he, won't he, Mitt Romney chose Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to be his running mate. The announcement was made in the battleground state of Virginia in Norfolk, with the flag-draped USS Wisconsin as the backdrop. Romney corrected himself after mistakenly calling Ryan the next president of the United States. Paul Ryan is a 7-term congressman and the architect of a blueprint that would dramatically change the role and responsibilities of the federal government. He's also a conservative on most social issues. We have two guests to join us today on Radio Times. Joel Goldstein is a professor of law at St. Louis University, where he studies and writes about the American vice presidency. And Joel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you, Marty.
Also with us is Jim Tankersley. He's economics correspondent for the National Journal. And Jim, nice to have you back with us as well.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, let me begin with you, Jim. And Romney's choice of Paul Ryan seems to have pleased both the Republicans and the Democrats. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells you that, in case you had any doubts, we're going to have a very divisive election. Here's why Congressman Ryan is such a divisive figure. It's not because of, you know, his personality. It's because of his policies. He has proposed a budget that which the House Republicans have passed the last 2 years, which would, as you put it, fundamentally change the role of government in our lives. And Democrats are up in arms about how it would scale back the growth of Medicare, Medicaid, and pretty much any other thing you can think of the government spending money on, to shrink it fairly dramatically over the next several decades. Republicans see him as a champion of limited government and of really bringing our deficit problem under control. Very starkly different visions, and whoever defines that vision best over the next, I don't know, month or two is probably going to be the one who gets the upper hand in this election.
Is it a sign, though, that Romney needed to cement his relationship with more conservative members of his own party?
I certainly think this has that effect. If you look at a vice presidential pick, sort of from a Bain Capital kind of standpoint, from a consultant standpoint, and you think, okay, what's the biggest thing any one pick? What's the biggest problem any one pick could solve for us? Paul Ryan solves a big problem. Mitt Romney has constantly had to reassure conservatives that he is one of them. I don't think he's going to have to do that anymore.
But do you also think, because Ryan has been much more specific about what he wants to do about the budget, where he would make tax cuts and things like that, and where he would eliminate programs, does he force Romney to be more specific about what he would do? Because Romney's been rather vague about what he would do if he became president.
Here's what's interesting. I mean, Paul Ryan has a real and deserved reputation as a policy wonk, but he leaves some gaps, pretty big blanks to fill in his policy details, too, and they just so happen to match up with some of the ones in Mitt Romney's plan. The biggest one is that both men want to reform the tax code. They want to cut marginal tax rates for people fairly dramatically. Congressman Ryan wants to do it a little bit more than Governor Romney does, but they would pay for that by eliminating loopholes, tax credits, tax deductions in the code. Economists say that this could create a lot of growth because it makes the code more efficient. But the trick is that those loopholes are hard to get rid of. They're really politically popular, the things like the mortgage deduction or the health insurance deduction. Well, neither Romney nor Ryan has actually said which deductions they'd get rid of. They keep saying, well, that's better left for later, better left for later. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty important detail, and I think you'll see some renewed pressure from the Democrats to try to get them to be specific on those, because it's the unpopular part of their plans.
Joel, let me get you in on the conversation. What do you make of Romney's pick?
Well, I think it was surprising in the sense that that he did seem to embrace the right wing of the Republican Party, and I think, as Jim suggests, I mean, it suggests that he felt that he needed to placate the Republican base. In some ways, that's not unusual for a Republican candidate who is identified with the moderate part of the Republican Party, as I think Governor Romney historically has been. Always takes somebody from the right wing. George H.W. Bush picked Dan Quayle, Bob Dole picked Jack Kemp, John McCain picked Sarah Palin. It was surprising to me because I didn't think that he would embrace the Ryan plan in quite the way he has now. I mean, he had endorsed it, but it seems to me that now he really owns it, and it largely will define, I think, the discussion or much of it in the next couple of months.
Joel, it's always an interesting courtship for a vice president. It's the job that everyone says they don't want, at least publicly says that they don't want. What did you make of the courtship? And there were certain names that were bandied about, including Paul Ryan's, but, you know, Tim Pawlenty and others. What did you make of of how Romney seemed to be testing the waters?
Well, it's a bit of a two-step. I mean, in the sense that in the early stage, everybody is saying primarily that they don't want it. But then once the invitations go out for vetting materials, people sort of soften that a little bit. Some of them, like Governor Pawlenty, said he didn't expect to get it. Governor Jindal said that he thought Ryan would be a great pick, and so forth. I think much of the process seemed to be pretty conventional. There seemed to be more, in the sense of the campaigning going on by the various candidates, fanning out and sort of auditioning. And I think one of the interesting aspects of it that I'd like to really know more about is that apparently Governor Romney made the decision on August the 5th, and yet for about 4 or 5 days, people were still acting as if the decision hadn't been made and people were out campaigning. I wonder if when he advised the people that he'd made the choice, and whether they whether any of them may have felt a little bit used if they were still out there in effect campaigning at a time that the choice had already been made.
Jim, can you give us any insight into the particular courtships that were going on?
No, other than to say that, I mean, it was clear from the get-go sort of who they considered to be their serious candidates. One of the interesting things about the email barrage that political and economics reporters get from the various campaigns is that you can sort of see who's important to them. And whenever they would have a big speech and then a bunch of Republicans would come out and say how great it was, or a bunch of Republicans would come out and denounce the president for something, like a jobs report number that comes out, there was a sort of familiar cast of characters that grew. And one thing I noticed was Paul Ryan sort of crept up in that list of characters. You sort of felt like you were seeing his name more often. It felt like they were rolling him out earlier than other people with his statements. So, that may be nothing, or it may have just reflected a move within the campaign to see what kind of traction he got.
Jim, let me go back to you, because Medicare seems to be a central issue, certainly for Paul Ryan. I think it makes it a central issue in the campaign now. And he wants to turn it into a capped voucher program for future retirees. Help us understand what he's saying. And I know there have been some analysis. The CBO and others have looked at this. How would this affect future retirees?
Well, the first thing to note is that the Congressman Ryan's plan doesn't apply to anybody who's 55 or older. And that's important for how they're going to try to sell it to senior citizens, but it also means that he proposes to solve America's deficit problems basically exempting the baby boomers, which is a fascinating sort of, it's a political shift and one that's going to cost a lot of money for the next generation.
Because there are a lot of baby boomers.
There are a lot of baby boomers. Here's the way that the plan works. With Medicare, instead of the current system, which is projected to grow at what everyone concedes is unsustainable rates, Congressman Ryan would convert it into sort of a payment system. Now, under his latest version of the plan, you could also choose to opt into traditional Medicare, but it's unclear exactly how that would work. The payment system, though, is like basically the government sends you a check every month with which to buy health insurance from a pool of health insurers they set up. But the trick is that the amount of that check would be capped at the rate of inflation in the economy plus 1%, which is a lot slower growth than healthcare costs have been growing now. Congressman Ryan is betting that the free market will respond to this and that that will slow the growth of healthcare costs. A lot of health policy experts don't see it that way. CBO has scored it as essentially a transfer of costs of healthcare, and that it's essentially going to get harder and harder for people who receive traditional Medicare benefits to achieve the same level of care, because they just won't be getting the money they're getting from the government won't be keeping pace from how much it would cost.
In fact, just underscoring that, what I read was the CBO said that by the year 2022, so a decade from now, the average person will be receiving $6,400 as a voucher, but that would not be enough to cover the cost of their care.
Right, and this is the problem. Now, that's the Medicare aspect. The other aspect of the budget is that it pretty dramatically scales back Medicaid, which is health care and assistance to poor and low-income people, and that's it does it through some block granting and, again, capping the growth. And CBO found that essentially in the out years, you're looking at Medicaid spending being about one quarter of what otherwise would have been. And then he caps spending on all other parts of sort of non-entitlement programs, including defense, down to a very low level, about 5% of the economy, which is much lower. I mean, that's sort of everything else government does, domestic spending, defense spending, other things. And that's pretty dramatic compared to I think it's like 9 or 10% of that occupies right now in the economy.
Joel, it's interesting. We're talking about Paul Ryan's budget plan. He is the vice presidential nominee, not the presidential nominee. Is that unusual when looking at running mates and whose policies are front and center?
I think it's very unusual. I don't really ever remember an instance where it's happened in quite this way. I mean, Bob Dole picked Jack Kemp in 1996 to emphasize economic issues and the supply side issues and so forth. But by 1996, those had been around for quite a while. They were associated by then with people other than Jack Kemp, including, to some extent, with Bob Dole. In 1952, Dwight Eisenhower picked Richard Nixon in part to emphasize the sort of the anti-communist theme. But again, that wasn't one that was as identified with Nixon as the Ryan plan is with Congressman Ryan. So I think this really is a unprecedented situation where the central idea seems to be coming from the second spot on the ticket.
At least a couple of days into this campaign with a now presidential and vice presidential running mate. And Jim, about a minute before our first break here, but Paul Ryan, as I understand it, worked with Jack Kemp and perhaps is a believer in some of Kemp's ideas about government.
Well, I mean, clearly, he's clearly sort of he wrote speeches for Jack Kemp, I believe, when he was the vice presidential nominee, and he, you know, a lot of his philosophy is very similar to Kemp's and to, you know, very traditional Republican supply-side ideas. I mean, this the idea that now, the fundamental argument that Romney and Ryan are now making, whether they make it explicitly or not, is government is the reason the economy's not growing fast enough. And if we can just scale back the size of the government enough, everything's going to be fine again. It's an interesting argument to make.
Well, and we'll pick up on that after this very short break. And that's Tim Tankersley. He's economics correspondent for the National Journal. Also with us is Joel Goldstein, professor of law at St. Louis University, studies and writes about the American vice presidency. We're talking about the fact that over the weekend, Mitt Romney chose Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to be his running mate. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital is committed to doing everything it can to fight stroke, using an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
35 years ago, Britain's out-of-work kids picked up guitars and changed music history.
Do you know what? The country's pretty bad. And do you know what? The television's pretty bad. And do you know what? The royalty's pretty bad. Do you know what? Everything's bad. Let's write a song about it.
This week on Sound Opinions, it's part one of our series on the year punk broke, 1977. We'll talk Sex Pistols and Buzzcocks with UK music writer John Savage.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Olympics have not always given a long-term lift to the cities that have hosted them, but after the 2012 Summer Games come to a close, many Londoners hope for a lasting impact for that city's youth.
I think it makes the dreams a little bit more reachable for them because they've seen it and it's in their backyard.
We'll talk about the legacy of the Olympic Games in London next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Mitt Romney significantly changed the 2012 race for the presidency when he announced on Saturday that Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin is going to be and is his running mate. We're talking about all of this with Joel Goldstein and Jim Tankersley and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jim, let me go back to something you said right before the break about, I guess, the Republicans running on this notion of supply side economics, that's really, I guess if you can distill it down to a couple of words, that's what their philosophy is. Haven't we tried this before?
We have. Now, the Ryan pick is interesting because, I mean, we have certainly tried this before, and this has been the Obama campaign's argument, and one that I think has gained some traction, in particular during the commercials that the president has been running during the Olympics, where he looks at the screen and says, you know, we tried that before, but we need to do something different. What the Ryan pick does, in a way, is double down on that philosophy, but add something to it, which is, you know, George Bush's tax cuts, Ronald Reagan's tax cuts, they also, you know, ended up with a lot higher deficits. And what Ryan and Romney are trying to argue is that they are going to be the ones who are more serious about spending cuts than any Republican or Democratic president has ever been, and that they are going to bring down the debt, and that bringing down the debt is going to unleash all this economic activity.
Well, and going back to the CBO, and the CBO looked at Ryan's blueprint, saying that there would not be a surplus for something like three decades.
Yeah, well, it's in part because he and Mitt Romney wants to do this too, layers of a tax cut on top of his spending cuts. So it makes it harder once if you start in a hole and then you fill it in with spending cuts, but then you dig it down again with tax cuts, then I mean, what you're going to end up with is a much smaller government, which, again, conservatives really believe is the key to higher economic activity. But you're not going to get that. You're not going to get that deficit down fast enough. And it'll be interesting to see if the Obama campaign, which so far has been lukewarm at best about talking about debt, because the president hasn't really proposed an aggressive plan to bring down the debt. If they try to pounce on that, if they're going to talk about, you know, a different type of an alternate vision of deficit reduction, which includes, you know, asking a lot the rich to pay a lot more.
Well, and just we're getting a bit into the weeds here, but it's important. I'll go back to you, Jim. And what Ryan is proposing are two tax brackets, 25% and 10%, with, I guess, the idea that if you get rid of some of these loopholes, you can bring in the same amount of money?
Right, exactly. You'd pay for that by getting rid of loopholes. The other thing he wants to do is to get rid of dividend and capital gains taxes, which are already much lower than they were for most of, you know, throughout the Clinton years. But if you do that, I saw a couple of my counterpart at The Atlantic, Derek Thompson, had a piece this weekend saying that if you had the Ryan tax brackets in place last year, Mitt Romney would have paid less than 1% of his income in taxes. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a big Democratic talking point, I think, is hey, these guys want to do something that really advantages the rich in tax policy while cutting a whole bunch of safety net programs that help the poor.
Joel, do you want to weigh in on any of this? We're getting into the weeds here, but I don't want to leave you out of the conversation.
Well, Jim is really the expert on this. And my guess is that much of the campaign is not going to get into the weeds as much, but I think in the coming days, the effort to define Governor Romney based upon the Ryan tax plan, I think will in budget plan will really be the centerpiece of the campaign. I think aren't there some subtle differences between the two of them? For instance, hasn't Representative Ryan wants to get rid of all capital gains, whereas I think his Governor Romney proposed to simply to reduce it.
Wants to keep the rate essentially where it is, unless they are included in his 20% across the board rate reduction, in which case they would go down a bit. But again, I think the framing here is going to be really much not in the weeds at all. It's going to be really about Romney and Ryan are going to argue that they are saving the middle class from the government, by which they really mean from the sort of the big transfer payments, taking money away from hardworking Americans in the middle and giving them to the people at the bottom. That's why they're continuing these welfare attacks. And Obama and Biden are going to argue that they are trying to save the middle class from the rich. And that's going to be a fascinating sort of two-front class war, I think, in the coming months.
But what's interesting, and Ryan is Catholic, the Catholic bishops have criticized his budget proposal, and I'm quoting here, saying that the plans will hurt hungry children, poor families, and vulnerable seniors. Jim?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the question is, are those where the swing voters are? Mm-hmm. And, you know, right now, this is a campaign really about trying to win those, you know, blue-collar, independent voters, mm-hmm. and to the extent that you can win them by promising things for the middle class, it'll be fascinating to me to see how much those voters respond to attacks saying that these, you know, the Ryan budget would be bad for the poor.
But does the Ryan budget, does it affect middle class people one way or the other, Jim?
It depends. The Republicans argued that it's going to help them a lot because it's going to make the economy go. I mean, the middle class people are the ones looking for jobs right now. On the other hand, you know, it Medicare and Social Security and the education spending and the federal budget, these are all programs that pull very well with the middle class and that affect middle class people, and that if they go away under the Ryan budget, that would have some big effects on the middle class.
Let me get some callers, and we have Jennifer from Roxborough joining us on Radio Times. And Jennifer, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is about the Democrats and talking about Medicaid. And it being really, it's not just a program for the poor, that many middle-class people who end up in nursing homes also rely heavily on Medicaid. When someone, you know, when they've exhausted their money, Medicaid is the next step. And I'm wondering why the Democrats haven't brought that up as a middle-class issue when we're talking about Medicaid cuts.
Jim, can you take that?
I don't know why the Democrats haven't brought it up yet. I assume that you will see any and every attempt by the Democrats to say that this is bad for the middle class, and that definitely will be part of it.
And just to fill in what Jennifer was saying, if we're talking about Medicaid, which is generally programs for the poor under the at least Ryan plan, I don't know if it's the Romney Ryan plan yet, but under the Ryan plan, those funds from the government, Jim, would be block granted. And then the states would choose how to spend the money.
Right, and again, it's a sort of similar thing to the Medicare. It's just it's block granted, but the program, the growth and the size of the block grants does not keep pace with the current growth of the program, so it sort of shrinks over time.
Let me see what Ken from Roslyn has to say. And Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
My point is that Romney and Ryan, and pretty much the whole Republican right wing, is focusing their need for these drastic budget plans that they have based on the desire to reduce the deficit, saying that it's out of control. However, I think it's very interesting that deficit is driven by two wars, an unfunded mandate on prescription drugs, and a huge tax cut that was put in place all by the Republican administration, and that the focus on a deficit that you can't turn around on a dime because of those problems seems to be getting lost in the entire argument. And it seems like it makes their whole proposal unbelievable that it's not tangible, because it's kind of really not even addressing our major problem right now.
Well, Ken, I appreciate
it's not our major problem.
No, I hear you, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Joel, anything you want to add to that? And then, Jim, I'll turn to you. Joel?
Well, I think that one of the interesting dynamics, I think, will be is that since Representative Ryan was in the Congress since 1999 and voted for a number of the measures in the Bush administration that coincided with the growth of the deficit, I suspect that will be a part of the campaign discussion. His votes will be fair game and will be very much part of the campaign rhetoric on the Democratic side.
Jim, can you flesh that out for us?
I actually want to just sort of riff off what Joel was saying, because I think it's really important. I mean, think about what we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. We've been talking about social safety net spending. We're talking about who ballooned the deficit. We're talking about levels of government debt. This is a election that's supposed to be focused on jobs, right? And this is an amazing pivot from both sides that we are with an 8.3% unemployment rate and not talking about two sort of competing plans to really get people back to work right away.
But aren't we hearing, based on what you said earlier, that from the Republican side, the idea is if you have a supply side kind of trickle down idea that, and if you help the wealthy people in this country, that money will trickle down and they'll be the job creators and that will help the economy. And it seems coming from the Democrats, it's you know, government investing in infrastructure, and that's a way of getting people back to work.
Right, right. Those two things are true. Those are their arguments, right. But it's just interesting that we are making, they're making them now almost as much or more in the context of deficit reduction, mm-hmm. or about, you know, priorities for where our money should come from, or fairness of who should have to pay, you know, what in taxes, as opposed to, I mean, I think this is actually another admission with the Ryan pick, is that Mitt Romney is saying that his sort of relentless attacks on the president, on this economy, have not been by themselves sufficient to get a lead in this race. But because now the race pivots to deficit reduction, it's a question of whether we will really get. I mean, neither of these plans, to be very honest, from an economist standpoint, from the folks I talk to, is going to do anything remotely close to what we need in the near term to get millions of Americans back to work who can't find a job right now. And we're not going to have that debate for a little while longer, at least while we you know, flesh out all the details about who does what about Medicare.
And Jim, I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes, and you had a piece recently in The Atlantic about Romney's dream, or as you call it, his pipe dream, or idea of creating something like 7 million jobs over the next, 10 years, something like that?
Yeah. I it's interesting. For that piece, I interviewed the economist the Romney campaign commissioned, a very smart guy named John Diamond at Rice, to analyze their plan. And he found that Romney's plan, if you filled in some blanks, which the campaign wouldn't even fill in for him, about what tax breaks go away, but if you do that sort of across-the-board tax reform that Romney has talked about that lowers rates and cleans out the code, then you'd get enough new growth to create 7 million jobs over the next 10 years. But John Diamond also told me that politically that's almost impossible, that he just doesn't have any faith that anybody, if you don't own those tough choices beforehand, if you're not campaigning on the idea that, hey, we need to get rid of the mortgage deduction, or we need to get rid of, you know, the child tax credit, or any number of popular things, because it's going to help the economy grow, then it's going to be really hard to pass that through Congress, and so you're not going to get the full benefits of the analysis he came up with.
Do you think we're going to have an interesting vice presidential debate in the fall? Jim?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really fun, and, you know, I mean, any vice presidential debate featuring Joe Biden is going to be interesting, just because. But this one's going to be fascinating. I'll tell you, as an economics reporter, I think there will be a lot of talk about what we've been talking about. I also am really looking forward to the foreign policy exchanges, because I think that's going to be a very interesting difference where Biden probably thinks he has an advantage, but, you know, again, when Joe Biden starts talking, you never know what's going to happen.
Well, on that note, Jim Tankersley, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. We called him up over the weekend to get him on the show today, and he's economics correspondent for the National Journal. Joel Goldstein staying with us for the rest of the hour. He's a professor of law at St. Louis University. In fact, studies and writes about the American vice presidency, and we will continue our conversation, probably not with the degree of specificity about some of these proposals, but speaking broadly and looking broadly at the role of vice presidents through history, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joel, though, I must ask you if you're looking forward to the vice presidential debate in the fall as well.
Well, I really am. It's probably not going to be as consequential or as riveting as the last one was, where the Palin-Biden debate, really, I think, because of Governor Palin's participation, really attracted a lot of interest. But I think Jim's absolutely right. I think it'll be a fascinating debate, both for the foreign policy. I mean, one of the things that's unique about the Republican ticket is it's the first time that I can recall where a ticket hasn't had one member on it who had a strong national security credential. You know, Ronald Reagan chose George H.W. Bush, who'd been the ambassador to the UN, director of the CIA. George W. Bush chose Dick Cheney, who'd been the Secretary of Defense during the Persian Gulf War. Governor Bill Clinton chose Al Gore, who'd been very involved with national security issues. This is the first time where we have a ticket that doesn't have somebody who has really made his or her name as a national security expert. So I think that should be interesting. And I think the other point that Jim makes, which I think is really an interesting one, is that in terms of the pivot of the discussion, in a sense, the adding Representative Ryan to the ticket really changes the discussion from where are we now vis-a-vis unemployment to where will we be in the future,
right.
How will the Democratic plan or the Republican plan impact people's lives in the future. And I would think that that's probably a discussion that President Obama is happy to have.
Well, even picking, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on Sarah Palin because it is past history, but it is interesting she was the last time a Republican chose a vice president, a running mate. Was that from your perspective as someone that has looked at vice presidents through history, was that a Hail Mary pass? Was that a mistake on McCain's part? Could he have done better?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that my own view is that in choosing a running mate, you have to, the threshold question you really have to ask is this person somebody who will be perceived as of presidential caliber? And I think that Governor Palin, based upon her really limited experience at the time she was chosen, having been governor of Alaska for less than 2 years, I think sort of from that standpoint didn't mm-hmm. measure up. And I think as the campaign went on, I think polls indicated that really Democrats, independents, but also Republicans concluded that she wasn't very presidential. I think she hurt Senator McCain, but I think he was going to lose anyhow. I think in Senator McCain's perspective, he, looking at the choice, I think he concluded that he was likely to lose if he picked Governor Pawlenty or one of the other possibilities, and thought that his only mm-hmm. chance was to energize the base and to choose a woman in the hopes that by doing so that it would attract some disgruntled Hillary Clinton voters. It certainly didn't work out that way.
And we're almost up on our second break here, but it's interesting the Vice President, Dick Cheney, said recently that Palin was the wrong choice. Do vice presidents usually speak out that way?
Well, that was... It wouldn't be unusual if a Democratic vice president made that comment about Governor Palin.
Exactly.
But it was unusual for Vice President Cheney. But they really are very different models, obviously. I mean, whether you like Dick Cheney or not, he's somebody who had spent a lot of time in public office, who had a resume of public service that was really impressive, chief of staff to President Ford when he was 34, leader in the on the leadership ladder in the House of Representatives, and then Secretary of Defense. So his resume and credentials were quite different than Governor Palin's.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Joel Goldstein, professor of law at St. Louis University, studies and writes about the American vice presidency. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Adult classes are forming now for the WHYY Hamilton Commons. Learn about shooting and editing digital video, as well as crafting your own documentary. Classes begin on September 12th with Intro to Shooting Video. On September 19th, enter the world of editing digital video. And in October, a 4-week class will help you craft your own documentary. For more information and a full course listing, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Peter Hiller. He grew up in New York City.
Around the playground, I was like in the bushes. I don't know, just as a kid, I wanted to be out of the city so bad.
Hiller became an expedition kayaker and adventure writer, and now has his first novel about the end of civilization. It's called The Dog Stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. The death of Garrett Reed after a long battle with addiction is a reminder that addiction is a complicated and chronic disease. Addiction researchers are urging healthcare providers and policymakers to treat addiction more like they do diabetes or heart disease. On the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear how prevention and ongoing treatment for addicts could fit into a primary care model. Today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen, talking with Joel Goldstein about vice presidents and the vice presidency, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Doug from Maple Shade to join our conversation. Doug, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, anybody who becomes vice president, by definition, could become president, you know, a heartbeat away.
Indeed.
So we do have to take this guy seriously, Paul Ryan, I mean. And I'm afraid that if we make the mistake of taking what he says at face value in terms of his current views, we'll be allowing him basically to cover up the views that he has held for decades. You know, it was as recently as 2005 that he gave the keynote address at the Atlas Society for Ayn Rand devotees. I've heard part of that speech. You know, his views have been very clear in the past, his radical views on his disbelief in government, essentially. You know, he doesn't believe in Medicare, you know, despite what he might want us to believe now. And I just think that, you know, he's tried to distance himself from Ayn Rand recently, saying he rejects her philosophy. I don't buy it for a minute, and I don't think the mainstream media should either.
Well, Doug, let me take your comment, and I'll just give a little quote from that 2005 speech where he does talk about Ayn Rand, and he says, "I grew up reading Ayn Rand, and it taught me quite a bit about who I am and what my value systems are, what my beliefs are, the reason I got involved in public service by and large. If I had to credit one thinker, one person, it would be Ayn Rand." And he's gone on to flesh that out, although I think distancing himself from her more recently. Joel, have you thought about this?
Well, I mean, I've certainly read and observed the same early influence that he indicated, and then in the last few years he has sort of retreated somewhat from that. I think you know, she's a controversial figure, and in some ways it's not surprising that he would retreat somewhat from it, given his political ambitions and so forth.
And her atheism on top of that. And that phone number again is 1-888-477-9499. Joel, we've been talking about the fact that Romney picked Paul Ryan. It's been in the news for the last, you know, 48 hours. Do voters care who the vice president is?
Well, it can be a little bit tricky. I mean, most people are going to make their decision based upon who's at the top of the ticket. But to some extent, people, and actually in this instance, Representative Ryan may play a larger role, in the sense that to the extent that his views are perceived as defining what Governor Romney believes, it can make a difference. In other words, if the Democrats are successful in associating Governor Romney with Representative Ryan's plan, and if the plan proves to be unpopular, well, then, in a sense, it can make a difference, not because people will say, "I'm going to vote Democratic because I don't like Representative Ryan," but because they'll say, "I'm voting Democratic because I don't like the economic plan of the Republican Party." And conversely, it could work the other way if the Ryan plan proves to be very popular. So sometimes a vice presidential candidate can make a difference to the extent that he or she helps define people's perception of the presidential candidate. Usually it's only going to have an impact at the margins, a couple of percentage points. But in a close election, that can make a difference, and particularly if it swings a few percentage points in a competitive state, that proves to be decisive. I mean, in 1976, Walter Mondale's
presence on the Democratic ticket, I think really was crucial to Jimmy Carter being elected. Carter narrowly won both the popular vote and the electoral vote. Mondale was very popular in states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, that provided the electoral vote margin, and Mondale spent a lot of time in those states. So it can make a difference in a close election, I believe.
And it is one of the first big public decisions that a candidate makes, yes?
Well, I think that's right, and that gets back to one of the things that a presidential candidate is thinking about in choosing a running mate is, what message is this going to send about me? For instance, when George W. Bush was choosing a running mate, he knew that one of the concerns that people had was that he lacked any sort of national security credential. In choosing Dick Cheney, he sent a message that he was going to surround himself with people who who understood the world and who understood diplomacy and national security. Governor Romney sent a message that I think was designed in part to please the Republican base, to energize them, as Jim said earlier, to really send the message that he really is one of them. So in that sense, it can make a difference.
You know, I'm thinking about the vetting process that goes on. I'm sure every candidate has their own style of vetting a running mate. But as we know, when McGovern chose Senator Thomas Eagleton, Eagleton actually had to resign a couple of weeks later, turned out he'd been hospitalized for depression, actually had electroshock therapy for that. And we also learned more recently about John Edwards' personal baggage, and he was John Kerry's selection as a running mate. There are risks, I guess, in selecting somebody.
Well, there certainly are. In the Eagleton situation was really in an earlier time where before the selection, Senator McGovern never sat down with Senator Eagleton. None of Senator McGovern's people ever sat down with Senator Eagleton and asked him the sort of detailed, specific questions that are now typically done. Senator Eagleton had been hospitalized three times for depression, but hadn't had a problem since 1966, had come to the Senate and had really proved himself to be really one of the leading lights, an up-and-coming person. A number of his colleagues, Majority Leader Mansfield, Ted Kennedy, Walter Mondale, Gaylord Nelson, all recommended him enthusiastically, and Eagleton really believed that he could handle any position and so accepted it. Nowadays, I think that situation wouldn't occur because you have this extensive vetting that surfaces a lot of this information. As you point out, though, it's not perfect.
No.
And we find out that with John Edwards, who had gone through presidential primaries in 2004, went through a vice presidential campaign in 2004, went through a presidential campaign in 2008, and it was only afterwards that aspects of his character really emerged. Spiro Agnew was elected vice president twice, even though he had accepted kickbacks allegedly in Maryland without that ever coming to light.
What do you make of the Obama-Biden relationship?
It's by all accounts, it's really been a very successful one. When Vice President Biden embarked on the vice presidency, I think there were some real challenges. The Cheney vice presidency had created a bit of a negative view of the office, the discussion of the imperial vice presidency. The styles of President Obama and Vice President Biden are so different. President Biden is very disciplined, but Vice President Biden not so disciplined. And also the age gap, almost 20 years between them. It's a little bit unusual to be working for somebody who's 20 years your junior. And Senator Biden, for 36 years, had been really his own person, had chaired two major committees in the Senate. But by all accounts, he's proved to be an effective advisor who's not afraid to walk into the Oval Office and tell the president exactly what's on his mind, even if it's different than what the other advisors are telling the president. He's taken on major troubleshooting assignments, helping to negotiate the START treaty with the Senate, the budget and the tax deals at the end of the 2010 congressional year. And he's taken on some ongoing roles, the disengagement of Iraq from Iraq, the implementation of the recovery plan, the middle-class task force. So it seems to be another in a line of very consequential vice presidencies. Going back to the point that Douglas was making about the importance of the vice president as a successor, that's been true for a long time, but what has been evident really since the Mondale vice president is that the vice president also plays a very important role in our government on an ongoing basis.
Well, in fact, wasn't it FDR's first vice president compared the job to a bucket of spit?
Yes, that was John Nance Garner made that comment. He served two terms with FDR, and then opposed FDR's decision to run for a third term. FDR dumped him, picked Henry Wallace, who over the opposition of the Democratic bosses, and then dumped Henry Wallace and picked Harry Truman as his third and final vice president. Harry Truman spent 82 days with very little contact with FDR, and when FDR died, after President Truman had been sworn in, somebody said to him, "I think there's something you ought to know about," and then told him for the first time about the Manhattan Project that President Truman was going to have to make decisions about within a few days. That, I think, would never happen again, because now vice presidents are very much in the loop. And that's been the case really since the Mondale vice presidency.
Let me get Josh from Conshohocken to join us. And Josh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks very much.
I'm
wondering if your guest has any thoughts about what Ryan isn't. He's not a woman. He's not Latino. What's the significance of the fact that Romney chose a white guy as his running mate?
Well, only he probably knows the direct answer to that question. But, Josh, let me take your call and toss it to Joel Goldstein. Any significance there?
Well, you know, I think Governor Romney was faced with a situation where he had a lot of needs. There are a lot of sort of gaps that he would have liked to have addressed. He has a deficit with Hispanic voters. He has a problem he'd like to do better among women voters. He wanted to energize the conservative base. He would like to have had a national security presence on the ticket. There was no candidate who could give him everything that he wanted. And the options to pick either somebody who would have perhaps helped with a Hispanic demographic or with women voters, the options also had some deficits. So I think, on balance, I think he apparently concluded that his best chance was to go with Representative Ryan. He's a Midwesterner, where a lot of the battleground states are. He helps him with the base of the Republican Party, and he might bring some energy to the ticket.
Thanks, Josh, for calling into Radio Times. Going back to you, Joel, from your perspective, who was the best vice president?
Well, I mean, in the sense that Mondale, I think, was the most important, in the sense that he really reimagined the office. Before Mondale, vice presidents thought that the way to be influential was to take some specific governmental program and be in charge of it. That hadn't worked out. And what Mondale figured out was he concluded that was a mistake, that what he wanted to do was to be a general across-the-board advisor to President Carter, to be available to take on significant troubleshooting assignments for the president. And that's what he did, and it was very successful. And then he basically convinced Vice President Bush of that model. Mondale got certain resources from Carter that Vice President Bush retained under President Reagan, and those resources and that vision of the job have been perpetuated. So I think Mondale was really the most important, maybe not the most influential within his administration, although he was influential, but I think was the most really important and historic, because he took a job that had been a joke for most of our history and turned it into a very much of a contributing position in our governmental structure.
And how often does this become a stepping stone to the presidency?
Well, 14 vice presidents have become president, nine following the death or the resignation of a president, five have been elected either directly from the vice presidency or, in Richard Nixon's case, he had been vice president, lost a very close election in 1960, but then was elected in 1968. But a number of people in recent times who have been vice president have become presidential candidates. Walter Mondale wasn't elected, but he became the Democratic nominee in 1984. George H.W. Bush became the first vice president, sitting vice president since Martin Van Buren in the 1830s to be elected from that office. And then, of course, Al Gore won the nomination in 2000, won the popular vote, but narrowly lost the electoral vote in 2000.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and I guess this is your season, is it not, as a vice presidential scholar?
Well, it is a time when people are focused on it, particularly during this election period, which is sort of a novelty in our system. Now that presidential nominations are resolved sooner, there's this period of time where the focus is on who will be the running mate, and it really has changed vice presidential selection in some interesting ways.
Well, Joel Goldstein, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a professor of law at St. Louis University. As I said, studies rights about the American vice presidency. And we began our conversation with Jim Tankersley, economics correspondent for the National Journal, talking about the fact that over the weekend, Mitt Romney selected Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin to be his running mate. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.